Blog Talk Radio.
You've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked. Bamboozled. Let us pray. Run on my.
Welcome to Our Common Ground. I'm Janice Graham, your host. Thank you for being with us tonight. Speaking truth to power and ourselves. Our Common Ground. Talk that matters.
We declare our rank on this earth to be a man, to be a human being, to be respected as a human being, to be given the rank of a human being in this society, on this earth, in this day, which we intend to bring into existence by any means necessary.
And we thank you so much for being with us here at Our Common Ground, where talk matters. It's Saturday, January 22nd, 2011, and we are just so pleased to have you with us. Alpo is with us tonight as our co-host. Thank you, Alpo, for being with us. How are you, sir?
Good evening, Janice. How are you this evening?
I'm doing okay. I'm going to be doing a sound check, Alpo, because I'm hearing gravelly.
I'm hearing the same.
I'm going to ask
maybe before
someone in our chat room to give me a sound check if we're okay. Looking in the chat room to try to get that right now. For those of you who are in the chat room, if you can respond, and we certainly welcome. Those of you in our chat room located at blogtalkradio.com/OCG, and you can join. We generally have a room full of chatters, people who listen and respond, add commentary to the Our Common Ground experience. And we also would like to let our listeners who are not in our chat room know that we appreciate having you with us. It's been a tough week, Alpo. Wouldn't you say?
Well, it's been just above a tough week. It's you know, you have to take a deep swallow. You have to get up, because we've definitely been knocked to the ground when it comes to what we believe and the people we follow. You know, the demise, if you will, of a Keith Olbermann. Just send shockwaves through the progressive liberal community.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly has been a week filled with a surety that things are not going to change, that this country has been besieged by a legion of small-minded, narrow-thinking, in many cases, people who oppose poor people who oppose middle-class working people who oppose everything but those principles, those actions that will, one, keep the wealthy, make them even more wealthy, and to destroy any semblance of change that may have come as a result of the resurgence of progressive-minded people participating in the political discourse. I think that is one of the ways in which we should be looking at it. I'm not exhaling.
Well, Dennis, from what I can see,
by all accounts, we have, since our last broadcast, we have, the House has voted to repeal health care measures that were progressive and independent and would ensure the American public that we would have at least fulfill our capacity to provide the kind of health care that this country has the capacity to provide to millions of people that did not have health care before the bill. I think that's major, Alison.
Janice?
I think we're having an audio problem.
Yes, it's very choppy. I mean, you're in and out. I can hear bits and pieces only of what the words that you're saying.
Really? And I'm thinking the same as you. I'm still looking for that audio check.
Well, I did put in the chat room that it was choppy, and it's still choppy.
Still choppy.
Still choppy.
Okay.
Why
don't you hold down the fort?
And okay,
I'll try it again.
I see YJ has joined us in the chat room with Davizor and Crazy Old Man Network. I haven't seen Crazy Old Man Network for a while. And like I said, and like Jenna said, we've taken a hit. But we've fallen, and now we get back up, and we just keep going. No one man defined the message, and no one man will stop the message. Mr. Keith Olbermann, as valuable as his voice has been in this liberal progressive community, we will continue to push forward. We will persevere. We will not allow this to dampen our spirits as we continue to move forward with a liberal progressive agenda. If we understand what is happening, and if we see what they are doing, it's so frustrating that we cannot get our elected officials, elected progressives, to really stand and make a better accounting of themselves in the fight.
Well, you know, Alpha, it's real hard for people who are not sure upon the foundation that they stand to act in a decided and concerted and insistent way on the things for which they believe. I think that we have not only a failing progressive political machine, I think that we have people that have been elected on one brand of principles who elect to operate on another brand. So I'm not sure. And once again, we welcome everyone. We're going to let you know that we have two guests tonight, Kevin Gray, who is a Counterpunch .org political magazine contributor and a long-term civil rights activist and political analyst. And he's coming to us from Columbia, South Carolina. And also in our second page, we're going to be talking with another old friend, Neil Franklin. He is the National Executive Director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition and a former law enforcement officer. He was a major in the state, Maryland State Police. We're going to be talking to them about a great number of issues, and we thank you so much for being with us and coming right up after this. We'll be talking with Kevin Gray.
Though this nation has proudly thought of itself as a ethnic melting pot, in things racial, we have always been, and we, I believe, continue to be, in too many ways, essentially a nation of cowards. Though race-related issues continue to occupy a significant portion of our political discussion, and though there remain many unresolved racial issues in this nation, we, average Americans, simply do not talk enough with each other about things racial.
This is our common ground, speaking truth to power and ourselves. Thank you for being with us tonight. Tonight at our common ground, black political analyst and contributor to counterpunch.org, Kevin Gray. And we also welcome back Neil Franklin, the executive director of the Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. We'll be talking about marijuana reform. We'll be talking about race, speaking truth to power, and ourselves. I'm Janice Grant. Stay tuned. Our Common Ground. Blog Talk Radio. I'm Janice Grant.
And we have with us tonight, co-hosting, as always, also, Kevin Gray.
Hi, Janice.
Kevin Alexander Gray.
Hi, Janice. How are you?
Welcome, my brother. Welcome again to Our Common Ground. How are you?
I can't complain. I went to see the grandkids play basketball and get beat like plantation slaves, but it was
Kevin, I
went to see my I think my grandson is 10, and the kids he was playing, they had to be in their teens. It was, hey, you got to support the kids, which I think is, you know, that, which is actually a good lead into this discussion, because, you know, ultimately this is about our grandkids and who all comes after us. And then that's all I thought about when I watched, besides watching them get beat so bad, you know, that's what it's really all about. What do you teach them? What do they fight for? What kind of politic do they understand? How do they put things into context? How do they judge what's going on now? How do they take the now and the past and apply it to the future? And of course, I was listening to the show before you introduced me, and I could have listened to the brother who was speaking talk for another 10, 15, 20 minutes, because I thought he was hitting all the right cues.
Well, he always does.
Yep.
And Alpha is co-hosting with me. I know when you've been with us before, I haven't had a co-host, but he keeps me in line. And you can hear him each Saturday.
Well, I know that's a tough job, too. I know that's a hard job, too. He keeps you kind of in line.
I'm doing better. As a matter of fact, by the time we end our broadcast tonight, for those of you who might have forgotten, by the time we end our broadcast tonight, Alpho and Kevin and Sister Marpessa, I will be 1 year older.
That's right.
Striking at midnight.
That's right.
I'm trying to get better. For those of you who do not know, I'm starting to post in our chat room some information about our guests tonight, because I think it's important for you to know who you are talking with and from where he comes. But, Kevin, try to give us a synopsis.
I'm going to try. Let me, before we go any further, I just want to, because I want to, don't want it to pass, I think that, and if the listeners don't know, I just want to thank you on behalf of people who support justice for all you did for the Scott sisters. I just want to make sure I get that in.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, all right, now.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
We still have a lot of work to do, but.
Well, you know, I remember
we
when.
We had them with us last Saturday.
I remember when you were one of the few people that were posting their stories, their story out there on the internet and in the public eye. So, you know, that struggle was a long struggle, but before the NAACP and the national people took notice of that story, there were people like you out there saying that an injustice was being done. So I want to make sure I just get that in, sister.
Well, I think that we cannot look at any situation and not call it what it is, no matter what it's about and what's being said about it.
Okay.
And that's one of the things that I appreciate about both of the gentlemen on this microphone tonight, is that we call truth to power. We have an eye and an insight. And one of the things that your work, Kevin, has really spoken to me about is that you conceptualize today in the context of history. And that brings some very, very clear understanding. Very clear understanding. And I wish more of us would do that. Give us a summary, Kevin, of where we are.
Well, I think we're at the point of reorganizing. It was interesting to watch on the internet over the course of the Dr. King holiday, people struggling to find or connect to that Dr. King message that spoke to where do we go from here, or the other America, or even in the Riverside speech, beyond war. And that's what I think I've been listening to those speeches and reading those speeches all week long. I think it's a time of reorganizing, a time to rebuild organizations or build new organizations, to find a more democratic, coherent, consistent leadership in our community, to go back and look at history and look at the fundamentals of our politics, the fundamentals of our movement, which I think in turn explain the fundamentals of our future. It's always been about fighting for the protection or advancement of due process, equal protection, equal treatment, equal opportunity, economic rights. And so if we can just get a focus on that, and in the context of how do you make that happen politically, how do you make that happen policy-wise, how do you make that happen as it relates to transferal of wealth, the wealth that was stolen from our ancestors, to where the disparities are here today, to how we move ahead in the future, what kind of expectations that we place on our public officials, what kind of expectations do we place on ourselves, what kind of sustainable communities do we build, and what's the ideology behind those communities. And so, we're just at that point where it seems like things are tough, and they are, because a lot of people are unemployed. I was reading that other America speech that Dr. King gave in 1967, 40 million people live below the poverty line. Right now it's close to 45 million plus people. And so it's still a matter of staying on focus, demanding, and I'm not ashamed to say the words, reparations or wealth transference for the free labor through slavery and Jim Crow that capitalism got out of us, and making sure that this government recognizes the wealth affront that this nation has launched or maintained against black people or people of enslaved African descent throughout the founding of this country. And you can't get too far away from that.
Well, you're absolutely right that you can't get too far away from it, but one of the most difficult things, Kevin, and you know this, is that we can't get people to come to it.
Well, it's always romantic to believe that it happened in the past, like it happened in Tunisia, or it's happening in Tunisia, where people just rise up. And I think that story is yet to be told. But, movements are based on a few people taking the point and everybody else follows behind them. And so, that's just the cross that you have to bear. Everybody's not going to be there with you. But you still have to build, and you still have to educate, and you still have to organize. Regardless of who's in the White House and who's in power, you still have to organize.
You talk about you were reading this past week some of King's, and I constantly read his Riverside church speech because I think that if you just transpose some places and locations and some dates, he would be speaking to us today saying the same thing. But I was also reading a piece that you wrote in 2002 this week on when you were organizing against the anti-Confederacy flag campaign in South Carolina. And I was thinking about what you did then and some of the other things that, you know, and I was looking at a 2007 piece you wrote for Counterpunch, and I was thinking to myself, well, why hasn't there been more black progressive movements on a lot of different planes? Education.
It's easy to sell out. You know,
social service reform.
But listen, it's easier for leadership to sell out. It is absolutely easier.
Mm-hmm.
It's more comfortable. You make more money. You don't worry about people being mad or upset with you. It's very comfortable for a certain class of people to sell us out or to sell out. And so you can't give that short shrift, especially when you're just trying to make it just living. And so, you know, I don't know how you get past that unless we get to a point where we're funding our own movements and we're funding our own politics. And it's not so dependent upon what funding comes through the Democratic Party or what funding comes through what company. I mean, even when you look at the troubles that the NAACP seem to be facing with Wells Fargo, well, you and I both know that when you look...
Yeah. Why don't you tell our audience who might not be familiar with what that's about?
Well,
it's happening primarily in Baltimore.
Well, Wells Fargo is just one of many banks that offered subprime loans to black folk and brown folk with the... I always thought that it was a Ponzi scheme from jump years ago when people were getting these quick, easy loans. And, you know, it's to keep you locked into a credit system. You know, you can have bad credit. You're still going to have to find a place to live. And regardless of how it's divvied up, who pays who, if you pay a landlord for property that you're renting, you're paying the same person that you would pay if you were buying. You just, you know, it's that the old adage, the poor pay more. And it was always meant for developers and for the bankers to get that quick buck and to pass that paper around, but it was never meant to establish communities. It was never meant to keep people in one particular place. And Wells Fargo was one of the biggest culprits in the subprime Ponzi scheme. And the NAACP, like a lot of organizations, I know the Rainbow Coalition, and everybody knows that. Who knows me knows I'm connected to Jesse Jackson, but I know they've received money. I wouldn't be surprised if NAN, the National Action Network, didn't receive money, or the Urban League. You know, these big corporations give money to civil rights, so-called civil rights organizations and leaders as part of their advertising budget, as a cost to the cost of doing business. So it's not any skin off their nose to give someone $100,000, $200,000, $1 million a year when you're making billions of dollars. And so the NAACP and, of course, Tavis Smiley and a whole lot of folk have taken money from some of the very people who have hoodwinked the community. And so, you know, but unless you can figure out a way that you can fund your organization, and that those organizations are democratic, in which you can vote on the leadership, and also in that you have to make sure that the people voting have some sort of consistent, coherent political philosophy that they're voting on, that they're holding people accountable to, then, you know, people are going to survive the way they think they have to survive.
Well, Kevin, wouldn't that be the same, and this is our fault, wouldn't that be the same blueprint that the big boys use, the corporations use with the media, and the corporations use with all of the other, say, be it the right-wing think tanks that are funded by the Koch brothers, and they just send this money down in a flow to, I guess, establish these.
They pay for their politics.
Yes.
That is the difference. That's, you know... course, I don't differentiate between Wells Fargo or Bank of America giving a civil rights organization money and them giving money to support advertising or to advertise on Sean Hannity's program or Rush Limbaugh's program. It's all the same thing. But one thing about the right is that they do fund their politics, and they do fund individuals that hold a place in their politics, which is something that we don't do.
And you're saying that these Wells Fargo, like, you know, Tavis Smiley has been linked to some of these very same entities, and along with the Action Network and Operation Push, this funding of these groups, per se, is it just that the politics, Action Network or NAACP, they are not as outspoken or as, in greater advocacy than your Freedom Works and your Heritage Foundations that are funded by the right? That is their total and only reason for existence is to carry their political water.
You know, well, the conversation is always difficult for me because, in all honesty, I know a lot of these people who run these organizations, and some of them I consider friends.
That's what I find, too, because you know them personally. You know where their heart is, and you also understand the corner in which they have placed themselves and the reasons why.
Right, and if you're living in America, you're getting your money from somebody. So that's the dilemma. But I'll go back to my main gripe with those organizations. Have they tried to really raise the money from their constituents, and have they been true to their constituents so that they feel as though if they put their money there, it would be money well put? And so that, you know, organizing is not easy. It's easy to take a check for $100,000 to give someone the space to say, hey, look what we're doing. We're giving money to these black folk. We ain't so bad. We hire black folk. That's the other thing that the power structure found out. If you can hire black folk to do the same thing white folk are doing, were doing to them that they were hollering about, and they'll stop hollering. So, I think that in the future that some organization is going to arise that is not so dependent upon that kind of corporate support to exist. And when we get to that point, then maybe we can get some movement. But right now, that's the dilemma is just in keeping the lights on. And for a lot of these guys, the dilemma is just in being able to be on TV and be seen and to be accepted.
Yeah,
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
There's another element, I think, organizationally that we have to understand, and we have to understand in the context of how in middle class and poor families, we do our own budgeting and financing. And that is, by the time these organizations get the money, they are so desperate because they have salaries, facility, they're behind in the rent, they're behind in paying the printers, they're behind in paying the telephone company, they're behind in paying everything.
So does every church on every corner. But so does every church on every corner in our community. And we give to those organizations on a regular basis, on a Wednesday, on a Sunday, and on whenever they ask us for some money. So it's about being there, which none of these organizations mm-hmm. are right now. They're not there.
Well, you know, if we can even extrapolate this part of the discussion into the area of big media. For instance, there has been, over the last 24 hours, I have had like hundreds of arguments I have been on threads of discussions, deep threads, about how we rely on, say, Keith Olbermann at MSNBC to partially take some of the pain out of trying to have public discourse on the progressive side. And then we say to a BET and a TV One and a Radio One, why aren't you aggressively addressing our issues in an informed way in the same way as MSNBC? And those organizations have the same exact kinds of problems as the community organizations because they are in such debt to the wrong people.
I just don't think that you're going to get the kind of revolutionary, and I'm not talking about revolution as in everybody go get their guns and storm the White House or storm the Congress, but revolution is as a change of consciousness and a change in how we do business, which leads to a change in politics. You're not going to get that on anybody's network, on any Comcast, Time Warner, anybody that has a stake in the status quo. You're just not going to get that. You're going to get limits to that, and even with Olbermann. You know, Olbermann's here, he's not here. I can take him or leave him. Sometimes he says something that I really would cheer him on, and then other times I'm like, man, what are you thinking about? So, and I thought that he was becoming a caricature. He was becoming the left's version of Rush Limbaugh. And so, you know, to some extent, it might be a good thing if he's a serious man that he does bow out of working with MSNBC and Comcast and the same people who are behind getting George Bush elected, the very person that he spent his career criticizing. Maybe that might be a good thing for his sanity. I just don't think that mm-hmm. you're going to find that you're not going to find that a revolutionary spirit at any of the major networks. We are talking about the people who built, and when you talk about MSNBC, who built their own tank to send, who was the journalist that got that died of the blood clot during the first days of the war for NBC?
Uh-huh.
I mean, they built their own little tank, and they all agree to be embedded, and these cats are making six figures. They're not thinking like the people who have to figure out how they're going to pay their rent. So, I think it might have been, as far as his integrity is concerned, it might have been a good move for him. I think that he has a true progressive spirit. I'll give him that. I thought that his comments after Tucson and this idea that we should quash the rhetoric, well, you know, who's going to be deciding what it is that we're going to be saying? I don't, you know, I'm not for speech codes or, you know, if someone's got their foot on my neck, I want to tell them in the most strongest terms, get your foot off my neck or else. So, you know, although I do separate laying blame to Sarah Palin for what happened in Tucson, but then I'm not nostalgic about America. I think America is and has always been a violent nation. And so this idea that people reminisce about the good old days, I'm trying to figure out what good old days they're talking about. Was it yesterday, the day before? I don't know. I mean, you know, you talk about what happened in Tucson, and people seem to forget that what 4 or 5 months ago, there was the shootings out at Fort Hood, Texas, where 32 people got killed. Or they forget about what happened at the Budweiser plant in Connecticut. People kill people in this country all the time. It's a violent country. And so, you know, the day that shooting was occurring in Tucson, here in South Carolina, they were firing off the cannons to commemorate the start of the Civil War. The week before that, they were having a secession ball. They fly a Confederate flag on the State House grounds in South Carolina. Now, you know what? If folk want to talk about the Civil War and about how things used to be, well, you know what? I'm going to talk to them like they talking to me. You want me to be a slave, I'd be dead first. But before I'm going to be dead, I'm not going to be the only one. But that's just me. I'm going to tell anybody else to talk like that. That's just me. So that's the reality of our history and the rhetoric that comes out of our history. And if people want to talk nice on national TV because they have limits, that's fine. As I said, back if Keep Overman doesn't want to be confined to those limits, then, you know, you have to step out of that. But I don't think that you're going to get any of the national networks to preach overthrowing a system that earns them billions and billions of dollars every year, every day. So, you know, I'm not crying any tears for Keith Olbermann. I just wish that we had a better mechanism for putting our own voices out there in a broader way, more independently. I mean, even we, you know, Janice, you and I, we communicate a lot on Facebook, and we get a lot of stuff out there, but we know there's limits to that. When they want to shut us down on Facebook, they'll shut us down. So
absolutely.
Yep, so you know, and even with BET, BET, isn't it owned by Viacom now? Or
yes.
Whatever. Not that you would trust what
it's
they're...
It's owned by Viacom.
Right, not that you would trust what they would put on in any regard, because they've made it clear that it's just about entertainment, and it's about a certain kind of entertainment. These kids down here, when you go to Atlanta, when you go to North Carolina, South Carolina, Louisiana, there's a music that these kids have out in the streets that you'll never hear on BET unless it conforms to somebody shaking their butt. So you know, I think that, you know, we need an independent, consistent message carrier. And I don't necessarily think that it has to be totally black. It has to certainly be progressive. But you know, if it's just about entertainment and buying into, let's say, sponsorship by the Washington Post, or sponsorship by the New York Times, or sponsorship by the Huffington Post, sponsorship. I mean, I came out of the black newspaper side of the house, and so, you know, there is a black media out there, and it's still not what it needs to be. What is not what it used to be. But I think that there needs to be a more radical, supported, independent black media that develops in this crucial time.
How do we begin to do that, Kevin? I mean, one of the things that always occurs to me is we start with what we have. We support what we have. I think that the Bay State Banner, for instance, here in Boston, is one of the finest community newspapers that you can get. But we don't have the black business structure, advertising structure. We don't have the black community structure that supports it. You know, and I can include myself in that, Mel...
King.
I want to say Mel Rivers, but Mel Rivers is somebody else. But the editor has been there since I came to Boston as a student. And I should be writing for the Bay State Banner. I should be writing something at least every 2 months for the Bay State Banner, and I don't do it.
Well,
and
the question
is how we begin to support our black media.
Well, the question would be, for someone that has worked with black media, and the good and the bad, does the publisher still have a community focus? And if he does, of course, they all struggle with advertising. But, you know, are they doing the things that make their paper grow? I know we're having problems here with one of our newspapers because the newspaper doesn't print anything other than the good news, and so that the advertisers will continue to stick with them. And then, of course, we have the paper in Charleston, which is our old paper, which is tied to the community, has been around a long time and is very popular, has a lot of local writers, so it you know, it can be done. So, you know, it is a matter of what kind of newspaper it is and what kind of publisher that you're working with, and is that publisher willing to commit to the community as opposed to committing to getting that dollar in? Because a lot of them, you know, mm-hmm. if they are controlling the circulation numbers and the national advertisers just kind of write them in because they say, man, you know, we'll write these black folk in and we won't have no trouble out of black folk. If it's just about that and that's the only reason they exist, then maybe something else needs to exist. But if they're really working in the community and finding the young black writers and training the young black writers, because that's something we still have to do, and then, you know, there's another function that we have to do with younger black writers, and that is the part of a political education and trying to help them put things into context. If you've got that kind of a newspaper locally, then that's the kind of thing I think you can build on now. And then, of course, you do all the things
well,
that everybody else is doing.
Well, it was your fault that I started feeling guilty about it. And I really did start feeling guilty about it because the editor has been a very committed and a very dedicated person to the development of the black community here in the city of Boston and the surrounding areas. But I was reading when one of the things that you asked on King Day in your piece, and for those of you who are listening, we're talking with Kevin Gray, the political analyst and activist of South Carolina. I just think of you as the president of South Carolina. But if you would like to know more about and read more about and hear more from Kevin Gray, you can go to his blog, which is really an e-zine, The New Liberator. And it's the address is being posted in the chat room at Our Common Ground. But for those of you who are listening, thenewliberator.wordpress.com. But one of the things that you said in your piece about King on this King Day was that we were facing a basic challenge. And the basic challenge was to discover how to organize our strength in terms of economic and political power. And that was a strange comment, Kevin, to make in the era of that we live in, that as black people we are looking up and out at a black president or African-American president, that we are still posing the same challenge.
We're still facing
the same challenge.
Did you, I posted the Where Do We Go From Here speech that King made at Stanford,
mm-hmm.
which
mm-hmm.
is really an economic speech. And
mm-hmm.
you kind of get the roots of Operation Breadbasket. You get the roots of these fair share agreements that have run amok at this point in history. And what King was trying to do, this whole idea of wealth development. Now, as I said, I'm a reparations brother. I think that descendants of enslaved Africans deserve an economic grubstake if you believe that slavery was a linchpin of capitalism. So fundamentally, I believe that. What happened with the black farmers and the Pickford settlement, that wasn't enough. But now, that doesn't mean intellectually that I'm hoping that the government sends everybody a $1 billion check. It could be a lot of different things. It could be the pressuring the president to support single payer, because that does at least get at the wealth disparity if you consider the amount of money that people pay in health care. You could talk about moratoriums on home mortgage foreclosures, or you can talk about some kind of homesteading act. You could talk about free public education. And of course, when you refer back to the King speech, and King talks about the triple evils of racism, exploitation, and militarism, then you say, well, we got soldiers in 700 places around the world. We got two wars going on. We've had a war every 20 years since we've been in existence. Maybe we ought to be talking about a peace dividend or anti-war dividend to pay for some of this transfer of wealth. And so then you have to figure out how to organize to make that happen, which we have not done since probably the death of Dr. King. I would think that shot, that murder of Dr. King in Memphis pretty much cut that kind of economic message off, and then everybody else just took the buyout. So I think we have to go back to those speeches, the where do we go from here speech, and look at that economic analysis about a transfer of wealth and or a third economic way. You know, the King talked about the capitalism and communism, and one being anti-individual and one being anti-social, and there needed to be a third way. Well, I think, and especially in regards to the president of China coming and the country being in debt to China and America not being at the top of the heap anymore, that we have to talk about what is sustainable. And I would argue that what is sustainable is to figure out how to make communities of color economically sustainable. Now, I hope I made sense of all that.
Yeah, you did. But what strikes me, Kevin, and I don't know what Alpha's response to it is, that over time we continue, you know, in that speech, what does King say? He talks a lot about how truth being crushed will rise again. And then I look at your work, some of the stuff you've done at Counterpunch, and some of the writings on the New Liberator, and we keep saying the same thing. In 2003, you wrote at Counterpunch, and I'm looking at it. We live in dangerous times. If we don't mobilize our children's lives, our lives and future is in peril. We must act. We are in 2011. You are saying the same thing. You are saying what King said before he was assassinated. And I'm wondering if at some point we have to stop and say, well, wait a minute. Evidently what we're doing is not working. You know the saying, keep doing what you're doing, keep getting what you're getting?
You know, we have lulls, and if you were, listen, I'm 53, and I ain't going to ask you how old you are, but Dr. King was 39 when he died. The thing that's missing in all this, when we got involved in politics, we were all young. And we were, and I asked a friend of mine, I said, how were we young and had a consistent, coherent politic even in our 20s and 30s? Where did we get
yes.
that from? Our kids don't have that. So our kids don't have that. I mean, the generation after us, our kids don't have what we had. So part of it is trying to figure out how to energize and mobilize them into some consistent movement, and it is about letting them lead.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's,
mm-hmm.
you know, you keep
so
saying it, you keep saying it.
Yeah,
I mean, you and your sister desegregated schools in Columbia, South Carolina. I desegregated a school in West Palm Beach, Florida. Those experiences politicized us at a very early age.
Exactly.
We understood. You know, one of the things that I love about my organization that Sister Marquesa and I and some others put together last year in response to a lot of things that's going on and our experiences and being able to share those experiences is we were part of a crossover. So we could see the past and see the future. And we're not creating that kind of opportunity for our children. We're not explaining. You know, like I listen to my mother's 86 years old. I listen to her talk about her childhood. I listen to her talk about the way things were for her when she was growing up. And I mirror them to my own childhood and say, my goodness, there was just so much progress in one generation. But then I look at what might be labeled progress between my generation and my adult daughter's generation and say, wait, there might have been movement, but I wouldn't necessarily call it progress.
Well, you have to. We have to figure out. And I'm actually, it's a chapter in this second book, and I've been working on the title of the chapter. I started out and I called the chapter "Bling," the Age of Reagan. And I thought about it. I said, well, you know, because Reagan and the era of Reagan, which we are still in, even with this president, we are in the Age of Reagan. And I thought about it. I said, well, the Age of Reagan, the Age of Oprah, the Age of Nike, the Age of the Two Michaels, the Age of Individualism, where when these kids fail, although we can look at the numbers and accumulate it, the numbers look at there's a huge ethnic, racial failure on our parts. And we've got these kids believing that it's all their individual fault, that it's not the system that was erected to protect a certain status quo that has them struggling to survive, and or you know, in and out of jail or whatever. It's their fault. We have to deconstruct all that, and talk about putting the context of our experience, our parents' experience, their parents' experience, and so on. You know, you always have to figure out a way to pass that down. Now, maybe, as I said, when you talk about building community organizations, you have to build community organizations, political organizations that have a politic with connected to them. I mean, you know, if they've got to stand for certain things, they've got to be anti-sexist, they've got to be anti-racist, they can't be the things that we're fighting against, internally or externally.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it may even mean having a freedom school component, which I think is important, because you have to, to some extent, help kids unlearn things. Because we turn these kids over to the school system that, as I said, you know, it's about if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere, the American dream. And we know that the American dream ain't all it's cracked up to be. So you have to have some sort of independent something to help deconstruct that imprint that they get from the school system, and have to give them some sort of coherent political analysis of things. And that's what's missing in a lot of the community organizations or the civil rights organizations. Right now, as I said, if you look at the main organizations that we have out there, be it the NAACP, the Rainbow NAN, or the Urban League, they're all leader-driven. You know, it's about that leader coming in and saving you. It's not about building on the local level. You know, you just have to go back to square one, which is what I've been arguing for, I guess, the last 10 years, which is, you know, at some point in time, I hope that some young person will pick up on it. And, you know, my job is just to push it down the road. It ain't necessarily at this point in my life to go out there and build it. I can help folk build it, but I think that, you know, it's more empowering that people build it for themselves.
Mm-hmm. You know, the last time you were with us at Our Common Ground, you were just about finished with the wonderful book, Waiting for Lightning to Strike, The Fundamentals of Black Politics. And we've got to take a break, but when we come back, I want to talk about that book and what you're working on now.
Okay.
Because I think that the key is us striking the right balance in community organizing and conceptualizing it in the political landscape in which we live. You're listening to Our Common Ground. I have Kevin Gray, the political analyst, with us in this first page, and my co-host, Alpha. When we come back, we'll talk more with Kevin Gray about political organizing, community organizing, and kind of like how we keep this ship going. And we'll take your calls. We have people on the board. We know 773 will be with you. 704 will be with you when we come back.
Oh, we be playing some happy songs tonight. Y'all ready? If y'all ready to say yes? Y'all ready to say yes?
Yeah.
is Our Common Ground at Blog Talk Radio, speaking truth to power and ourselves.
You know that the ice cream scoop can make a child smile, and that by slowing us down, the traffic light can keep us going. You know that the lawnmower makes life easier, that the blood bank makes life possible. But did you know all these ideas came from the minds of African Americans? Support the United Negro College Fund, because a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Visit uncf.org or call 1-800-332-UNCF. Brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
If we looked into the eyes of evil, pure evil, and said to ourselves, what is this country coming to? What have these bigoted racists, and I'll repeat it, bigoted racists. If anybody wants to challenge me on that, have at.
Reload some Alpha, the Mo Alpha Show, on Truthworks Network. More of the Alpha Show, 4 p.m., Truthworks Network.
President Barack Obama, stand and fight. You can win against the politics of no and no idea. You can win against obstruction. Yes, you can.
We still too often feel that we must go to them to ask permission to be us. We still think we have to ask authorization whether or not we can tell our story our way. We still think that we can only build the America that we want by getting permission from them to have access to make it what we want it to be. The reality of it is that we, America, wouldn't be what it is had we not taken the initiative and the prerogative to make it our way despite what they wanted us to do. With the issue of miseducation, my primary belief is that our greatest disempowerment has been the systematic effort to make us unconscious of our conscious power. That somehow we don't know our real power. We don't know who we are. I think that.
And thank you for being with us here at Our Common Ground. Our guest in this first page is Kevin Gray, the political analyst and the author of a book that I highly recommend for reading and for your library and for gifts, Waiting for Lightning to Strike, The Fundamentals of Black Politics. And you can do a Google a search on your favorite book store and purchase this book by Kevin Gray. You can also find him at thenewliberator.wordpress.com. And also, he is a contributing writer for counterpunch.org, and he can be heard with his friend. You know, Kevin, you and Dave crack me up.
Because that's that satellite radio where you can say anything you want to say.
I know. He is a crazy man.
he and I go way back, and we met in Central Park, I think back in 92, where he forced me to get up on stage in the middle of 35,000 people and sing This Land Is Your Land. I said, you're the only white boy in America
know,
that can make me do this. But he's a great brother.
If you don't know Dave Marsh, you can catch him on Sirius Radio 146 on Sundays 4 to 5, live from the land of hopes and dreams. I did see a photograph of you and Dave in Central Park. Yeah, it looked like you were trying to figure out what planet did these people bring me on.
Well, you know,
we're
going
to go to our phones.
And I met Phil Spector that summer, too.
Oh, really?
Yep, I met
wow.
Phil Spector that summer. That was an interesting year. As you can imagine.
I know. I mean, we do some things on this journey. 773, you're on the air with Kevin Gray and Alpho at Our Common Ground. I respect you, Hotep. What's up?
Hey, Janice, Alpho, Kevin, this is House
Music. The House Music Lover.
What's going on? It's good to hear you guys.
Yep.
Hey, House, how's it going?
It's all right. I just wanted to call in and tell Kevin, first heard of you through Janice, but as you just mentioned, you were with Dave Marsh, that third hour of his show, and that's where I get my biggest dose of you.
Thank you,
and you guys are good. I hadn't heard of Dave until I was listening to Mark, and he filled in for Dave. Dave filled in for Mark, and I've been hooked since, and that was sometime last year, and I try and catch you guys' show every Sunday. And what's really refreshing is not just his take, but he gets to bring you in and it really compound on a fresh take and a different spin. And with your background, you seem like you always related back to a struggle, an organization struggle, and a what can we do in terms of moving forward, and which I really appreciate. And one of the things I'm seeing that's really difficult that I keep trying to over the last few months, as I've realized, try to vocalize, is that in the struggle to wake people up about what's really going on, because we have a black president now, and he's part of the concrete, the stone. He's Washington, he's the president, because he's that big block right there to get people, especially black folks, to wake up and organize. It's almost like to organize against him. And just what's going to be so difficult, because people are going to be hesitant, if not downright ignorant, in knowing his part, his involvement, and being willing to speak up against him.
Well, I mean, you can't give short shrift to how much people want to be accepted by white folk and the system generally,
mm-hmm.
and they vest that in Obama. So
right.
you got to factor that in.
But that's so misguided right now, because I think one of the truest things Barack Obama said was during the one of the debates. Somebody asked a question about Dr. King. Who would he favor, him or McCain? I can't remember McCain's answer, but I'm sure it was dumb. But Barack Obama said that, look, I don't think he would support either one of us. He would just hold whoever won office accountable. But the problem with most people, especially black people, is that they don't want to hold him accountable. They just want to say, well, he's our first black president, so let him do what he can do or has to do, and it'll be all right. And
I looked at the latest polls on how people felt about the direction of the country, and black folk were more optimistic about the direction of the country than whites, even with double-digit unemployment.
Exactly.
But, you know, I still think that, you know, you have to you give people their space.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that you try to let them overwhelm you with their false consciousness. But I think that you still maintain what the empire is about, and that's how you get around focusing on Barack and whether or not people have their success or failure or their identity all wrapped up in him. And mm-hmm. ultimately, as I said, if you're consistent with it, then they're going to come to your point of view. I wrote a piece about Bill Clinton way back. Yeah, I had never been with Bill Clinton. I was with Jesse.
And it was scathing. Did you not say that Bill Clinton in that piece was not a lightning strike. You said that. Wait a minute. Please let me
remember
this one.
He's a Southern cracker, and that's probably why I'll never be on MSNBC, because I have said that about him. So,
a version of Thurman. That's what you said.
And black folk were not mad at Bill Clinton until he came to South Carolina and likened Barack to Jesse Jackson. That's when they got mad. And for all the wrong reasons. Like for that, why they liked him for all the wrong reasons. They liked him because, you know, he played the saxophone and he screwed around.
Mm-hmm.
He was musical and he screwed.
Yes.
Just black stereotypes.
And he claimed he didn't inhale.
So, you know, I just
don't think that people can bring all of the issues together in the way that you brought them together in Waiting for Lightning to Strike. Because one of the things that I think that you did was, you know, you brought together all of the reasons that we have this descent of black leadership into what you call total ineffectiveness. And you brought the itinerary, the personal itinerary of Barack Obama, the book. I was a little bit confused because the book was published right before he was inaugurated, or right after.
It was right before. It was the second book, The Audacity of Hope. I did a review on The Audacity of Hope for the Progressive magazine, and you know, it was just a boring book. I mean, even if you compared it to Profiles in Courage, or even Jesse's book, Straight from the Heart, or Ross Perot's book. As a political book, I didn't think it was all that good. It was just something that introduced the candidate. I think the more telling book is Dreams from My Father. And I've included some passages from that book in the second book, The Decline of Black Politics, from Malcolm X to Barack Obama, and where he talks about Langston Hughes, Du Bois, Malcolm X, and Baldwin, when he discovered Baldwin and when he was searching for his blackness. And he considered Baldwin, Du Bois, and Langston Hughes bitter, angry men. But now, if you consider that brother grew up in Hawaii, and who raised him, and I'm not saying it as a negative, of course he doesn't have the same experience that you had growing up in Boston or I had growing up in South Carolina. And that's what people seem to forget. I mean, you know, no doubt in America he is, when you look at him, he's black, or he's a person of color. But even as I write in this book, when he came on the scene, his political role model was John F. Kennedy. And that's who he patterned his policy.
And Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
And Abraham Lincoln
was the one that kind of like messed me up.
And he was, well, you know what, I might could go with that, but he was Abraham Lincoln without Grant and Sherman. He was Abraham Lincoln asking Robert E. Lee to take over the Union.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then you look at what you point out in the book, Kevin. One of the things that I thought was brilliant about the book is you mirror him to Bill Clinton, how Bill Clinton blocked Lonnie Guinier in the same way that, and as you say, you flash forward to the dismissal of Van Jones, the one authentic person that he had on his staff.
Right. But although, that, you know, to be fair to Lonnie, because, you know, when Lonnie was talking about real structural change in politics, if you're talking about cumulative voting, proportional representation, which is how black folks have gained their comeuppance in the Democratic Party from Fannie Lou Hamer, through Shirley Chisholm, through Jesse Jackson, through Barack Obama. This idea of proportional representation is why Barack Obama emerged as a viable candidate, be it in Iowa, South Carolina. Then you know, that's his political lineage more so than John Kennedy. So just
okay, I get you.
Just for him to say that.
I mean, I lived in West Palm Beach, Florida. And Andrew Brimmer was a friend of my father's. And I witnessed how Kennedy moved so easily through segregation and Jim Crow. For instance, Andrew Brimmer could not be housed in a hotel and was housed at our home. And, you know, and he was on Kennedy's staff, for crying out loud. And people don't understand that. The book is Waiting for Lightning to Strike, The Fundamentals of Black Politics. And what's the title of the new book, Kevin?
It's called The Decline of Black Politics, From Malcolm X to Barack Obama, although in my preface I struggle with the subtitle because I thought the subtitle was sexist. And then, as I said, if you look at where we really are politically today, I love Malcolm, but I would link our movement in national politics back to Fannie Lou Hamer as opposed to Malcolm. And I would have opted, okay, if I had a choice in it, I would have opted to do that. But, of course, you know, when you go from a radical icon to a mainstream icon, you know, they wanted the book to come out right after he got elected, and I just kind of drug my feet on it. But I think it's going to be an interesting book. You know, a lot of things that we're talking about this evening, the confusion that people seem to have in their mind about where our politics come from and where it's going and where it's at, I'm trying to cut through some of that in this book, this idea of the messianic leadership and waiting for the one leader and how things are organized. You know, as you said, you know, you and I desegregated schools. There were a lot of folk like us across the country and a lot of parents like our parents that put their kids out there on the front line, or they stood out on the front line. And that's how things move. You know, the title could have easily had been From Oliver Brown, who was the plaintiff in Brown versus Board of Education. You know, Oliver Brown worked at the railroad shop, I think for the Santa Fe Railroad. So, you know, movements aren't necessarily hinged on the great man, the great woman emerging. It's about folk on an everyday basis figuring out, you know, we got to fight this and organizing it to fight it locally. And everybody don't sign up first time out. You just got to know that.
Mm-hmm.
Ain't never going to happen.
Will you come back and talk with us about the new book?
Sister, you know you always in touch with me. I don't know why you even said that. You know that you way in touch. Anytime you call me, I'm going to answer your call.
Well, I certainly thank you. You are a brilliant organizing mind. And, you know, I try to figure out how come people, you know, like I will send lists to people like Keith Olbermann and Rachel Maddow and other people and say, here are some people, here are some voices that you need to hear. Because once you hear them, you will be more informed about what you're talking about and the landscape that you need to widen in terms of your what you're doing in TV, radio, whatever it is. But, Kevin, I just think that, you know, one of the things that I say all the time we have to do is we have to do more writing. We have to stop talking, sit down, get a pencil, and start writing.
There you go.
Because the written word is so enduring. And
at least to put the record down. At least
struggle.
To set the record.
Yes, absolutely. House, thank you so much for your call. I hope you'll
thanks,
stay
Janet.
With us.
And if I can,
Kevin,
you know,
when's the new book coming out?
Don't ask me that, Harold. You ask your question. You're asking the publisher's question.
I just wanted to thank Kevin. One of the first times I called Dave Marsh, somehow he got me talking about my conversion, and he let me talk for like 15 minutes or so, and trying to talk through all these bewilderments and confoundments I had found over the last 2 or 3 years. Got off the phone. Kevin came on.
And talked about you some more.
He did. You did, actually. But what amazed me is that you got it. And you were able to sum up what I couldn't say in 15, 20 minutes in the one simple sentence, which was he realized that since he became a Muslim, that people really, 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 really don't like him now. And I was like, the brother gets it. So, yeah, man, I would definitely try and get your books and definitely keep you up front as one of the people I need to listen to and read, you know, just to stay in tune. So thanks a lot, man. I appreciate everything you do.
I appreciate you.
Thank you very much.
As I always say, the real Kevin Gray is at the New Liberator. The New Liberator WordPress.com, and you can also find him at counterpunch.org. Kevin, thank you so very much for coming with and being with us again and expounding on things that sometimes get all of us very confused.
I hope I made some sense.
And I'm really looking forward to the new book. Alpha?
Kevin, I want to thank you. This has been very informative for me. I can hear and understand and basically go the way you're speaking. But at our highest point, you're absolutely right about your assessment of where we need to go and the organizations, the so-called leaders and representation we need.
Brother, listen, if I could get some of those speeches that I've been hearing in the break, I'd appreciate that.
you can join us every Saturday night, and I know your number.
Yeah, I see. Okay.
Well, don't be so hard on those basketball players down there. I've got a swimmer up here, and you just have to keep telling them they're doing good.
All right.
Kevin Gray,
all right.
Thank you so
all
much.
Right. Yep.
And as we are in touch. I love you, my brother. That was my brother, Kevin Gray. You're listening to Our Common Ground at Blog Talk Radio. I'm here with our co-host, Alpha. And when we come back, we're going to be talking with yet another Our Common Ground friend, Neil Franklin. He's the National Executive Director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. We'll be right back. You stay with us, won't you?
You're listening to Our Common Ground. Alpha's on board. Don't you dare touch that mouse. We'll be right back at Our Common Ground.
Say if you want a wish to come true, never tell anyone. But there is one wish that can make the difference between life and death. And this wish can only come true if you tell someone. Please let your family know you want to be an organ donor.
I believe in truth.
I believe in truth.
I believe in truth.
I believe in truth.
Truth Works Network.
I'm Janice Graham. Join me on TruthWorks Network, Conversations in Deep Waters.
Hi, I'm Dr. Deborah Napier, and I would love to have you join me on TruthWorks Network here, and I am restoring hope, healing through connection at TruthWorks Network.
This is Alpha. It would be my honor if you would join TruthWorks Network.
Hi, I'm Denise Bowles, and I'd like you to join me on TruthWorks Network.
Live talk programming, TruthWorks Network, premiering February 1st with Dr. Deborah, Denise Bowles, and Alpha. We're working truth Monday through Friday at TruthWorks Network Radio. Come get your truth on.
Truth. Truth Works Network.
And we hope you will join us, too, at TruthWorks Network. It all begins on February 1st with the premiere show with Dr. Deborah. And the show is called A Heart for My People, and we hope that at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, you'll join her in her premiere weekly show, A Heart for My People. Thank you again for being with us, and Alpha, thank you for being with us once again. In the second half, we're going to be talking with Neil Franklin of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And we're going to be talking about the controversy and the hostilities by police officers, officers across this country on the issue of marijuana reform. You stay with us, and thank you for being with us, and we'll come right back with Neil Franklin.
Vitamin, gentlemen, that sun is hot and plenty bright. Let's get out of business and get home tonight, vitamin. Auctioning slaves is a real high art. Bring that young gal, Roy, she's good for a start. Vitamin, get 'em in.
In America, the U.S. imprisons nearly 500,000 people for nonviolent drug offense in the so-called war on drugs, which accounts for most of this prison increase. It is consuming and chewing up young black men. Three times as many blacks are in jail as are in college. Blacks are 13% of all drug users, but roughly one half of all drug-related prisoners. Today, there are more American blacks in prison than there were slaves. American blacks are imprisoned at nearly six times the rate of South African blacks during apartheid. Tonight, at Our Common Ground, we are very afraid. We'll be talking with Neil Franklin, a retired Maryland State Police major, and now the executive director of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. We should be very afraid. The war on drugs has created a form of slavery in America for which there will be no Emancipation Proclamation. What are the lies? What are the confusions? And why do we continue to spend tax dollars on a strategic program that does not work? How the war on drugs has created the new slavery right here in America, 2011. Stay tuned at Our Common Ground. We'll be right back.
Just look at her face, she sure ain't homely. Like Sheba in the Bible, she's black but comely. Vitamin. Lord, I thought of three. Can I hear three? Step up, Jan, take a good look, see. Cause I know you want her once you see her. She's young and right, make a darn good breeder, vitamin. She's good in the field, she can sew and cook. Strip her down, Roy, let the gentleman look. She's full up front and ample behind. Examine her teeth if you got a mind, vitamin, get them in.
And the war on drugs also certainly has brought us to a new form of slavery in this country. It is feeding a private prison industrial complex, and it is draining the coffers of law enforcement dry and the resources of law enforcement that should be placed in other places are being drawn against something that's not working. Neil Franklin, my brother, thank you so much for being with us one more time at Our Common Ground. And I have to say, this is your first appearance since you've become the National Executive Director of LEAP.
Yes, it is, Janice, my sister, and I'm so glad to be back. It's been too long.
Yeah, it really has. Neil, for those of you who are not familiar with LEAP, take us over exactly what Law Enforcement Against Prohibition is trying to do, Neil.
Sure.
You are a 33-year law enforcement veteran.
Yes, 33
and,
years.
You have been involved with LEAP. How many years now?
I've been with LEAP, even though I knew about them when they first started in 2002 and made my first contact then, I've been speaking for them just a little over 2 years. And LEAP, so folks know, it began, just real quick here, it began with five cops back in 2002 who had their careers in law enforcement and fighting the war on drugs. One of the main organizers, Jack Cole, did undercover narcotics work in New Jersey and New York for over 15 years. And these five cops realized that the war on drugs wasn't working. They saw how many people were going to prison who didn't deserve to be there, and the money that was being spent, and the people who were dying, and they decided to form this organization. And it started with those five guys, and now we're an international organization with close to 40,000 members. Now, all of those members are not cops. There's a few thousand who are a mixture of cops, judges, prosecutors, and prison officials, corrections, and we even have some folks, former DEA and FBI agents on board.
Mm-hmm.
And what we want to do, what we have set out to do, is to do what the initial cause was about. I mean, when they started the war on drugs, there were some people who thought that they were going to reduce crime, disease, death, and addiction. And as we all know, that hasn't worked over the past four decades. And we set out, we aim to do the very same thing, but we're going to do it by eliminating the war on drugs and putting some common sense into our drug policies and let our drug policies be constructed and led by health professionals, not law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. Now, recently there was an article in the Huffington Post that talked about police officers across the country who had become very hostile to drug reform proposals across the board. How did this start, and what does it mean, Neil?
Well, and you're right. One of the main organizations out there in opposition to this drug, into our policy reform, is an organization from California called the California Narcotics Officers Association. And it's led by an individual by the name of Ron Brooks, who just recently came here to Maryland to testify against medical cannabis. And, you know, there are many reasons as to why they are opposed. For the most part, the men and the women who are in the trenches every day in the streets, most of them get it that this is not a winnable war, this is not a war that's doing our country any good, and that we need to change. See, most of these police officers came on board to go after rapists and murderers and child pedophiles and those who commit domestic violence and those violent acts against people. The problem is with the hierarchy. The problem is with those administrators who are balancing their budget through federal funds. They're balancing their budgets on the backs of asset forfeiture laws throughout the country. They also have built dynasties. Now, you have to realize when you build a dynasty such as the DEA, Office of National Drug Control Policy, and the likes, and many of these other law enforcement agencies that are out there, when you build these dynasties, you're talking about power and control. And how many people do you know that want to relinquish any of their power and control? So there are many different dynamics, and many different things that come into this. It's not just one thing. And then you have the tunnel vision. Then you have the lies that we've been fed throughout these decades. And Janice, I was one of these people. You know, I wasn't into it for the power or the control, but I had the blinders on for a couple of decades here, and I truly started to believe all the things that I had been taught, you know, in that wonderful world of law enforcement that we had, that we could actually put a stop to the drugs coming into our country. You know, they have you believing that, you know, but then there comes a time when you're making all these seizures, you're locking up all these people, and then you realize that, you know what, every year we're making larger seizures of drugs, and we're locking up more people, and as soon as we arrest people, there are more people into the business, and so there comes a time when you really have to just stop. And for me, unfortunately, for me, as you know, it took the death of a close friend. And so the hierarchy, if we could do something with the hierarchy, then we'd make some headway here.
And how, I mean, we're talking about LEAP being in place since 2008 as a national organization. Now you've moved into the international arena. Who's listening to LEAP at this point? I know my good friend Judge Gray, who by the way has been here a number of times.
Yeah.
You've got judges, you've got law enforcement, you've got prosecutors, you've got some sections of state attorney's office across this country talking about how the war on drugs and the mandate to have a war on drugs is simply draining, running states into contributing to states going into bankruptcy, and nobody's listening.
Yeah, one of the things that's a good point, but one of the things you will notice, the people who are listening, actually the people who are coming out and speaking against this, one thing you notice that most of them just happen to be retired or no longer in the business, because now there's no self-interest. But first and foremost, they feel safe. They know that their careers cannot be jeopardized, and their careers are no longer in jeopardy from those who have the power to either terminate them or, you know, stifle their growth or what have you. We have a Border Patrol officer who was terminated because he expressed his views. Now, he's still doing his job, but he expressed his view to a coworker that, you know, yeah, those men and women at LEAP, you know, they really have something there because they know we have to change our drug policies. They know we have to legalize, regulate, and control our drugs to have a better chance of keeping this stuff away from our kids, and so that we don't continue to drive our country deeper and deeper into bankruptcy. Now, his coworker went back and mentioned that to his supervisor, and they terminated this guy. And, of course, we're going to support him. And there was another parole officer in Arizona who had the very same thing happen to him last month. So this is why many of the men and women who are currently in law enforcement who do believe, as we do at LEAP, are afraid to speak out and won't speak out because they have their families to take care of. And, of course, many of them are, you know, very concerned about their careers and what have you. But the people who are listening and making the turn are the ones that do leave law enforcement. And you mentioned some names. I mean, we have, on our advisory board, we have folks from Canada. We have folks from the UK, from Belgium, from Colombia, from New Mexico, from, you know, in the states, outside of the states, Brazil, Wales. We're about to open up a branch in Australia right now. See, this just isn't the United States we're talking about. This is a worldwide issue. The UN follows the lead of the United States, and because of that, the rest of the world is pretty much under the control of U.S. policies. There are many countries that want to get out and from under these Arcanian drug policies that we have, these draconian policies. Portugal has made great headway. Since 2002, Portugal has decriminalized every drug where you can possess a small amount. Teenage use of all drugs has decreased substantially. AIDS and Hep C, hepatitis, new cases are virtually non-existent. Overdose rates are in the basement. They've had great success, and all they did was decriminalize. They still have the illegal market, so they still have the violence surrounding that. But because they took that one step to decriminalize, they're having great success. And treatment has gone up considerably because people are no longer afraid to seek treatment. And they have the money to do it. They've even closed a prison or two. So people are listening. People are listening to us. We have a branch also in Canada. We're going to open up a branch in Poland. And we're also looking at Mexico.
It seems like the momentum of the increased number of prisons that are being built in this country, prisons that are private in nature, and that this war on drugs is being used to also, as part of an enforcement strategy against immigrants who are both legal and illegal in this country. So I'm not seeing the outcomes, Neil, and that's what I want to try to get my brain around.
Okay.
Because the reform is not coming. There is still a drug war. Michelle Alexander, who wrote The New Jim Crow, has documented how this entire drug war has created a whole generation of a new form of both Jim Crow and slavery in this country, and I just don't see any changes.
Well, let me say this to you. First of all, Michelle's book, marvelous, absolutely marvelous. It is my new Bible for this effort. And Michelle and I have started to do some things together, and you're going to see and hear more about that. Now,
that's great.
I mean, for your listeners, they have to, I mean, if you're listening, you have to get that book, The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. It will open your eyes. And she wrote it. She wrote it for us. She wrote it for, actually, she says she wrote it for herself because, you know, she was completely blind to this until something pushed her in that direction. But I won't spoil it for you. Go ahead and get the book. Just a couple of decades ago, Janice, if you had taken a poll for those who thought that we should legalize, and I'll just start with marijuana, that we should legalize marijuana, a few decades back, I believe that poll was probably down around 20-something percent. But nationally, if you take that same poll today, it's very, very close to 50% in the high 40s, very high 40s. So the bar is moving. We are moving the bar. The people who are listening are people like your listeners. And we've come to realize that we're not going to move this issue through our legislators. We're not going to move it through Capitol Hill. We're going to move this issue at the grassroots level, in the neighborhood, in the community centers, through the citizens. It was the citizens in California who decided to put that issue for marijuana legalization in a referendum so that they could vote for it during the last election. And unfortunately, in most of our states here on the East Coast, we do not have that option for a referendum. But on the West Coast, they're exercising that right that they have. And in 2012, you're going to not only see, mark my word on this. You're not only going to see California do it again, you're going to see probably Colorado and maybe Arizona and maybe another state. You might even see one or two on the East Coast try it, maybe like Maine. So people are listening. There is traction. We are moving the issue. And the five guys that I mentioned who started LEAP back in 2002, 8 years ago, said that we don't think we'll see it in our lifetime, but we're going to get this issue moving because we need to. But you know what? I think they will see it move substantially in their lifetime. I have no doubt that they will see the legalization of marijuana in their lifetime.
Well, Mr. Franklin, this is Alpha.
Alpha, how you doing?
I'm okay. And speaking of the movement in California, and speaking of just marijuana in and of itself, the defeat of that ballot initiative in California was basically due to the amount of money that was poured in against it. And I'll continue to yell and scream it. It's not really about the drug itself, whether to legalize it or not, because they know that is the foothold. If you legalize marijuana, you can no longer disallow hemp.
Alpha,
and the truth about hemp has to do with oil companies.
Yes.
And if you can get hemp back into the, you know, hemp was our major crop in this country from, what was it, 1776 to 1938?
Absolutely. Just talk to George Washington. He'll tell you.
You can grow three crops a year, and you don't need pesticides. It grows in all kind of weather.
Yes.
And it'll just destroy the 25,000 oil-based products that are made. And it's with the big interest and the big lobby from oil that keeps marijuana from being legalized.
You're absolutely right. Alpha, you're absolutely right. One of the main issues, this is not so much an issue of, even though they have used such policies to control populations of people from the Chinese to the Mexicans and now to blacks, but it's an economic issue. It is truly an economic issue. Not just the oils, but there are a number of other companies that don't want to see hemp legally grown in this country. Talk about something that would get us out of this financial state that we're in now as a country. Let's bring hemp back. We import all of our hemp products right now. If I'm not mistaken, I believe companies such as DuPont had a role with hemp leaving our countryside.
Yes.
There are
cotton, paper, rope.
Right. The lumber industry doesn't want it. Cotton industry doesn't want it. And one of the key things you mentioned, Alpha, was that the average farmer could grow this and get so much from it themselves. They could the biofuels that they can generate from it to run their equipment.
Absolutely. Medicine.
Yeah, medicines, the list is long. And what's really interesting, and the reason we know this is true, because you can grow industrial hemp, and there is no THC. You can't get high off of it. You know, so why not let it grow if it's not, if we're not talking economics here, if we're not talking the powers that be, the special interests that are keeping it out of our field. So, I mean, there are many issues here surrounding this topic tonight. But Alpha, you just hit a big one. It is economics, in addition to just the overall war on drugs itself in an effort to control populations of people. And Michelle really digs into the history of drug prohibition in this country, going back into the early 1900s with the Harrison Act and opium and Chinese and bringing it forward, marijuana and the Mexicans and Nixon's aide Alderman and some of the things Alderman said about quotes from Nixon at the height, at the beginning of the war on drugs. So it's very, very interesting, and the people are going to be the ones to move this because our politicians, they're just not the leaders that they need to be.
Well, there's one question that I have for you, Neil, that has just been plaguing me throughout the years, and that is policing is supposed to exist to make society safer, and I'm not getting this about hunting down nonviolent marijuana users at the expense of the thousands of unsolved assaults, rapes, and murders and warrants on domestic violence that don't get served. I know this thing about that there is there's an economy in the communities of law enforcement people, especially the FBI, state attorneys, investigators, et cetera, around nonviolent marijuana users, and it has to do with you don't put yourself in harm's way when you're dealing with those people and making those kind of arrests. But how do local politicians and state politicians continue to reward law enforcement policies around this issue? Is it something that we're not doing out here?
Oh, God. Well, we just, it begins with us, I mean, we just really have to educate ourselves more than what we currently do. Let me say this first, Janice, is that as it's been 2 years, a little over 2 years I've been speaking for LEAP, and as I travel the country, speaking to different groups and seeing the people who are involved in actually pushing this issue, I didn't see many of us. I didn't see many blacks in this fight. And I really believe it's because of a lack of good information surrounding this topic. And, you know, as you talk about the crimes that go unsolved, back in the 1960s, the late 60s, we solved 9 out of 10 murders in this country. Today, we only solve 6 out of 10. And it's the same percentages for rapes in this country. And you talked about domestic violence. We've gotten away. Policing has gotten away from its true intent. And its true intent is to be out there to protect people from violent people, not to protect people from themselves because they choose to use a particular substance. But policing has been used for something that it was not originally intended for. And now we, and from that also comes the prison industrial complex. There's another incentive. There's another special interest as to why it's going to be difficult making this turn. The prison industrial complex has basically become a jobs program for rural America. And when you have prison guards lobbying against drug policy reform, lobbying against the release of nonviolent drug offenders, what does that tell you? And well, and some of these unions have more money than you can imagine.
Well, Kevin, let me say this, and I caught this bit from when you first started, when you first came in. You said for the longest time you were of that line of thinking about how how coming in and fighting the crime and fighting the drugs especially, to something to that effect, that and it was due to your to them to the brainwashing.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't that like parallel to military? Isn't that what they do to the soldiers in the military? They keep them thinking as a collective, kind of like the Borg.
Yeah.
And Star Trek. If you keep them, you know, unable to express their own individual feelings or think on their own, of you know, the type of thinking that you know, separates people from just following the herd. And if you are, and if you follow the herd like that, you'll listen to that same voice of telling you that this is wrong or this is, and you become vulnerable to someone else's ideology.
Absolutely.
Because that's what we find, and that's where it comes out of the military. And
absolutely,
when you come out of the military with that mindset, then aren't most of the military, aren't most of the prison guards ex-military, aren't most of the Blackwater mercenaries ex-military because of the collective thought?
Yes.
And when you get into the police force, it turns into a thing of you don't question authority because that's what you've learned, that's what you have been indoctrinated to.
Absolutely. And law enforcement and policing, in recruiting, they really heavily recruit prior military because they already had that thinking process, it's already ingrained in them. Now all you have to do is give them a new book to study.
Right, it's indoctrination. It's the
right.
same thing that they've accused this president of trying to indoctrinate their children. And it's the
right.
same kind of indoctrination that you get in kind of this factory-like atmosphere that is the military.
Absolutely.
Don't think on your own. Don't think on your own. Don't challenge authority. Don't question. Charge up that hill despite the oncoming fire that will surely kill you.
You
ask for the bigger collective.
Right. Another thing that makes it even more difficult than the average profession to think different, to think differently and to act on your own, is that if you choose to do so, you really do feel as though you are on your own, because over the years, law enforcement has developed a culture of us and them.
Right.
And if you're not one of us, you're one of them, but you can't be one of them because them, they don't like you. In many of our cities, you're not liked by the community. You're not embraced by the community because of the style of policing that takes place in our communities. So if you choose to walk to the beat of a different drum, you will find yourself out there with no backup. You will find yourself out there in the middle of a struggle with someone and no one comes to your aid, and you know this. So therefore, you are not going to step out on your own. You are not going to think independently. You're going to march to the beat of their drum.
And to me, that is what's so damaging to not just us as a society, but especially to our community, the African American community, because
right.
we've been indoctrinated, and we've been scarred for over the last 450 years per se.
Yeah,
and when you get into that thinking, this is what you get, and this is what our temperature is because mm-hmm. of how and who set that thermostat.
Right. If we ever want to connect law enforcement and community again, and I'm not talking about rural America, it's a completely different scene.
I'm for the most part talking about our major metropolitan areas. If we ever want to connect law enforcement and community, we do have to begin with a drastic change to our drug policies. We do have to end this prohibition period, because until we do, we'll never get there. It's the foundation. Even though cops profile for many things, they use racial profiling for many things, 85% of racial profiling deals with our war on drugs. 85% of the time they stop a brother or a sister in a car or walking along the street to search them, it's about drugs. That's where we need to begin.
Or the profiling of having the drugs.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And the random stop turns into probable cause for any and everything.
Correct. More times than not, when you're being stopped for something, what's in the back of that police officer's mind, because I know it was in the back of my mind, when I stopped you, yeah, you may have committed a minor violation or something, but that's not what I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about looking for drugs.
Well, one of the things that I think that kind of history, that kind of experience with most people in the African-American community, the kind of racial profiling that we know occurs, it sets up, Neil, a barrier between people in the community who could or who would or who might mobilize to stop this insanity called the war on drugs. But, you know, you're looking at rogue cops. You're looking at thug cops. I mean, I witnessed six cops taking down a 16-year-old here in Boston. I didn't witness it personally. I witnessed it on the TV. But it doesn't matter, because someone was smart enough to videotape it on a telephone. And I watched what those men did to that kid. And he simply was in a place where people didn't understand why he was there and what he was doing. So the Boston police were called. And they literally whipped this poor kid. I mean, he was standing when they, six thugs, police thugs. And Neil, that's the thing that's got to stop. In addition to, if you want a community to support the right thing that's coming from law enforcement or whatever, people have to trust that they're not supporting that whole system of how black children are being brutalized on the street. They're being killed. They're being manipulated into prison. So how do we bring some sanity to our own advocacy, and how do we come together as two different kinds of communities?
Well,
You're an ex-major in the state police. I know you. I know that you're not that kind of cop.
Right, and there's Janice, most of the cops that are out there are not that kind of cop. But unfortunately, they're enough to make this a significant issue.
Yeah.
And Neil,
we're gonna have to talk about this at another time. For some reason, I'm being told by Blog Talk Radio this show is about to close in a minute.
Okay.
So, do you think we can call? We can have you back next week?
Oh, absolutely.
It's gonna shut down.
For you?
Okay.
Yes.
I apologize for this, and I apologize to the audience. And we'll see you next week.
You've been listening to Our Common Ground at Blog Talk Radio. I'm Janice Graham. Thank you for being with us. These are our stories. This is our mission. This is our challenge. We thank you for your calls and your input. We hope you'll join us each Saturday night here at Our Common Ground. Our Common Ground, speaking truth to power and ourselves. This is Alternative Activist Empowerment Talk Radio.
Oh, we be playing some happy songs tonight. Y'all ready? If y'all ready to say yeah? Y'all ready to say yeah?
Okay.
Okay, shut the music off. We're off. We're no longer streaming.
What happened?
What do you mean what happened? It's time for the show to go off. You only had 2 hours.
It's supposed to go off at 1 o'clock.
No, you only scheduled 2 hours.
I thought I scheduled the full...
When I looked at it, Janice... When I looked at the show, it said an hour, and when I came in, it had an hour and 50-something minutes.
I wasn't looking at it.
We only had 2 hours.
I took everything it offered, so they changed it?
While the show was going... Huh? While the show was going, I just went into TruthWorks and scheduled.
They only offered me 120 minutes.
Okay. While the show was going, I went into TruthWorks because I don't have a show scheduled next Saturday for the Alpha show. So I scheduled 2 hours on TruthWorks rather than do the jumping. Because Blog Talk really had me jacked up. Because on the Internet Explorer side, the damn thing kept freezing. I almost couldn't upload the promo for Our Common Ground, the one that you sent me in the email.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And because it wouldn't the program wouldn't respond. And then when it did, I had uploaded the damn file 3 times.
Well, how come I'm not getting this. I've been getting 180 minutes.
Janice, on Our Common Ground, you've been getting 180?
Yeah.
Okay, because the only thing it showed, when you started the show tonight, it said you were up for 2 hours. And I scheduled 4 shows, you know, starting on the 29th on TruthWorks. I thought I won't be doing the show, an Alpha show, on Blog Talk. It'll all be
mm-hmm. Okay, I'm trying to schedule. It's only giving me 120 minutes.
What,
see, I told you that was a fluke.
In Our Common Ground?
When it was giving me the 3 hours?
Right. It's only giving you 120 minutes.
Yeah, it's only offering me 120 minutes now.
I wonder if they're doing
it. It was offering me 180. The other shows, the last three shows have been 180.
Right, right. I wonder if India's got the same, is getting the same thing.
She better check it, because I would never have known if that lady hadn't come up in my ear.
I put it in the private chat. Didn't you see me in the private?
No, I didn't.
3 minutes.
I wasn't, I didn't see it.
And I'm in TruthWorks. And I guess I will, let's see, I don't know what the hell is going on. So there's something up with Blog Talk.
Yeah. Yeah, why? What's going on now?
It's been giving me all kind of not responding, and all kind of funny windows have been popping up, and I just tried to open the browser, and nothing happened. I went back and did it again, then two windows opened,
mm-hmm.
That kind of stuff.
Well, I wouldn't have known nothing if that lady hadn't come up in my ear and said 60 seconds. I went, what? Because I wanted to talk about the Oberman thing in the third hour. Okay, well, it is what it is.
There ain't going to be no Oberman. and I've been reading all, you know, he's got over 35,000 comments.
Really?
And on that story on Huffington Post, and I say 35,000, and that's the last time I looked, and that was before 8 o'clock. And there were 296 that were unposted, that were waiting to be posted.
Uh-huh.
You know, and this bit about everybody sitting together and, fuck that.
See, if I didn't think I had the 3 hours, I never would have had two guests, because Kevin could have been an hour and a half.
True.
Kevin.
Yeah, you're right. He could have been. I was looking at the clock. I was wondering. I was like, what the hell? And why am I? Yeah, he's got.
Well.
34,500 comments on this, and how in the hell am I not signed in? I didn't sign. Oh, yes, I am signed in. But it's just ridiculous, you know. And it, to me, it's like, what the hell, you know? And he had 2 years left on his contract.
I know.
So
yeah,
well,
he can, and he can't do anything for 2 years.
Huh? I guarantee you they're going to keep him off the air for 2 years.
Yeah, I bet he does. Mm-mm-mm. I told you that 3 hours was wrong.
3 hours?
The 3 hours I had last week and the week before that and the week before that.
Okay, but you had 3 hours. I wasn't disputing that it was wrong. I didn't know what was going on.
Well, okay. We'll see. Because the contract does say 2 hours. India better check hers.
Well, she might. They might have, you know, cut hers down to 2 hours, just like. You know,
yeah,
y'all been blindsided by this 3 hours.
Yep. Okay, Alpha. You know, I was a little slow tonight. I think my brain is tired. I think I need to get some sleep. Not getting much sleep, Stephen. Up and down all night long. You had two good shows today.
Thank you, Janice. Tonight's show was good. I enjoyed both the guests, even though I couldn't think of their damn name earlier. Kevin Gray and Neil Frank.
I know you called Neil Kevin.
I'm like, who's Neil Kevin? Kevin Franklin and Neil Gray?
I always thought Kevin and I were the same age. Oh, thank you for my birthday greetings.
Oh, that's tomorrow. What's his name? Is Stephen Charles?
It's now.
Well, it's only 11 o'clock, a little after 11 here. And it's Stephen Charles' birthday yesterday, according on
yesterday,
Saturday.
Yeah.
Saturday was Stephen Charles' birthday. But I got two grandbabies with birthdays.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
Sam Yeti died.
And great grandbabies. Energizer Baby's birthday is on the 27th.
Gladys and Jamie going to be on Black Unity tomorrow. Oh, wow. Tabiti Lewis and Carla Thomas, I'm sharing a birthday with a whole bunch of people.
Yeah, well, what do you got planned for your birthday? What are they? Are the grandkids still there?
Imani's still here.
Oh, okay.
We're supposed to be going out for brunch tomorrow, but I don't feel like I don't want to go nowhere.
Imani's
already admonished me. I know, shit. Go get the food and bring it back home.
Too damn cold.
How about that?
Damn, the rent is too damn
high. It really is.
Too cold. I don't want to hear about the rent being too damn high. It's too damn cold.
I know.
It's a minus windshield factor. It gets down to 7 degrees.
Is that what it is?
This morning it was 0 with a minus 13 windshield factor.
Mm-mm-mm.
I'm like, are you kidding? I'm not going out there. I'm not going out there.
That's how I feel about it, Alpha. I don't want to go nowhere. Come and make me some, make me some crab cakes or something. Shit.
Yeah, I can go for some
Chesapeake.
What? I can go for some Chesapeake Bay. You right there in Boston. What's the price of lobster? What's the price of lobster there in Boston?
I have no idea.
I haven't heard
lobster. Whatever they cost when, when you get there.
I haven't had lobster here in going on 30 years. And I prefer shrimp over crab.
But I want some crab cakes.
And you like the Phillips?
Uh-huh.
See, I like the Chesapeake Bay.
I use Chesapeake Bay in a lot of my cooking. The seasoning.
Oh, I'm talking about the crab
cakes. I do.
I don't know nothing about the Chesapeake Bay seasoning. I just know the Chesapeake Bay crab cake.
You don't use Chesapeake Bay seasoning?
Nope. Never. We don't even have
when
it.
You cook fish?
Only thing we have
look
here.
They don't know. How, y'all go home.
All
the
we know about Chesapeake is gumbo. Are they still in the chat room? Yeah, well. They like being in the chat room.
I was going to shout out to Brother Boy Bay about his new name. I got my notes here. It's Nat Turner's birthday.
I pulled up what's his name's webpage? Kevin Gray?
Who?
Is his picture?
Uh-huh.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh.
He wasn't in prison?
No.
Okay, I'm just asking. I mean, he could go for an ex-con, you know?
Oh, Lordy. Alpha, I'm going. I'm going to shut down the switchboard.
Dennis, you have a good
shut purpose. Down this computer.
You have a good birthday.
Did you see this article? Did you see this article? Why are some cops so hostile to marijuana policy reform?
Did I see what article?
Why are some cops so hostile to marijuana policy reform?
Because that's what. Like I explained to Neil Franklin, that's just that indoctrination. That's that, you know, people who go into the military are simply giving up their minds. And you see these commercials being about something bigger than yourself.
Was the State of the Union address tonight?
Tuesday.
Oh.
Madam Speaker, the President of the United States, nigga! Why somebody screaming? I'm
looking at. Oh, that's them swearing in. Oh, okay. That area of Huffington, she's a snake. She is a snake.
You are
a snake in the grass.
And if, you know, think about it. If you can make a living like they make a living and make the money that they make, you know, they give up. You know, I think a lot of people would be willing to give up their beliefs and their, you know, the things that the principles.
Mm-hmm.
That money buys a lot of principles and a lot of beliefs.
That's right.
And that's what people don't understand.
Right.
You know, you get people who are supposed to be interested in the black community. And when they dangle that $10 in front of them, they go, oh, okay, give me that money. You niggas either wake up or lose out. And that's the bottom line there.
The folks talking about, you know, they sell out. Say they ain't sell out, they done made it. They making their money. Y'all the ignorant ones, because there's too many of you all that have just won't wake up.
Oh, you know, did you know that the president had Didi Bridgewater singing at the Chinese dinner? And they're going to be really going to be talking about Sasha, because Sasha was speaking Chinese. To the President Hu Jintao.
I see. Sasha Obama speaks Chinese.
Yes.
Vatican slams prostitution scandal. Oh, they didn't slam pedophilia.
I know. They're going to put her ass right on out of the White House.
Who? Sasha?
Sasha.
Yeah. Let me put it like this. That big black woman in that red dress, you talking about Mama Grizzly. I can see her now taking off her shoes and her earrings. And the rings off of, and putting on rings on her fingers to kick somebody's ass.
What are you talking about?
Talking about them kicking Sasha out of the White House.
I can tell
y'all can see Michelle Obama taking her shoes off and her earrings out her ear.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
Kick
uh-huh.
somebody's ass. Ain't this a bitch?
Mm-mm-mm. She looks gorgeous in that red dress. God damn, that woman knows she look good in her clothes. I don't care what nobody says. And the little rugrats, the little Obama rugrats.
Yeah.
They had they looked all dressed up too. They're getting so big. Little black girls in the White House. That's all I got to say about it.
You know, here's the story. Prince William's balding hastened his engagement. Dude.
Did you like my Oscar Brown Jr. I used tonight? You didn't even notice.
Okay. I'm like, Oscar? I didn't hear nothing on Sesame Street. What are you talking about?
You didn't hear his slave auction bid him in?
I didn't know. I guess I didn't
bid
know.
Bid him in. Yeah, that's Oscar. That's pure Oscar there.
Oh, this is criminal. What is this they got in the snow? They got two brown bears mauling something saying Green Bay Packers. Real bears mauling an inanimate object. Corporate contribution.
Okay, Alpha, I'm going to go. I got to shut down.
Hey. And you have a good birthday.
What?
I said, and you have a good birthday.
Thank you, sir.
And take care.
Okay, I'll talk to you tomorrow.
All right, take care.